Ready to jump into a new book? I have good news. This one's a little less depressing than the last few stories that we've been in. This one has some hopeful aspects to it. This one, we've been in this, where we've been in the storyline has been in the era of God's discipline, and that's actually where we are. But this particular story, which is really just a microcosm of events in the grand story that God is telling throughout the Old Testament into the New Covenant, this particular story is a more hopeful one. It has some strange elements about it. We're going to spend a few weeks on it. What I'm going to do today is mostly set up for the story. I'm actually, if you were here a couple of weeks ago, I did 13 points. You remember making it through that? Which is not something that I choose to do very often. I'm going to bless you today with just one. and I'm going to say it towards the beginning of my teaching, and then I'm going to come back to it at the end of my teaching. Before I do that, I'm going to confess something to you. And I'm going to confess this to you, and I'm going to tell you ahead of time, I already feel like there's some of you that are going to judge me. Just a second, I need to work up my courage. I went to watch Barbie this week. There it is. If you're visiting here, my name is Aaron. I'm one of the pastors here at Church on the Rock Homer. I went with my wife and a couple of my teenagers and a couple of their friends. We don't really go to the theater very often. We're just at a stage of life that doesn't really, it's not conducive to that. And we got to the theater about 20 minutes early here on Pioneer. And as I pulled up, there was a line all the way out across the parking lot of mostly teenage girls dressed in pink. This is all part of my confession. And so I pulled up and I said to Jenny and the kids, why don't you hop out and I'll go park? And what I meant was, why don't you hop out and I'm gonna go hide in the car until I can duck into the theater. I sat in the car for about 10 minutes and my conscience pricked me for deserting my wife. So I got out of the car, I walked over, and the line was still just as long as it was. And so I'm standing there in line, and on Pioneer Avenue, Javen Halpin, Javen and Jen Halpin are walking. Javen's pushing like a man. He's pushing a double stroller with his two babies in it. And he's walking past on Pioneer, and I know Javen, we're friends. And Javen looks at me, and with a one-word question just perfectly triggered all of my insecurities. He looked up and said, Barbie? Yeah, here I am. I cannot hide. I will say this. this is the part now where I defend myself after making light of it. I actually appreciate storytellers who are both earnest and explicit regarding the point of their story. And I will say, to their credit, even if I have some disagreements regarding our view of the world and our view of what ails the world, I actually find it to be very refreshingly informative to listen to a storyteller who comes from a different framework than I, who's earnest about telling their story and explicit about the point they're trying to make. So there. And actually, I find it, I found it fascinating that we're now jumping into, because this is the largest movie in the country, right? Major blockbuster, that we're jumping into a story about a woman who is, in many senses, is sort of victimized by very, very, very powerful male leadership. So this is what we're going to do. I'm going to set up the story a little bit in Esther, and I'm going to give you some background that'll help you put this story in its rightful place, and then I'm going to tell the story as we normally do, and then I'm going to kind of come back around and arrive at sort of our one conclusion. So for those of you who have not been here, for those of you who are maybe less familiar with the structure of the narrative of the Old Testament, where we're at in the story in the book of Esther is that God had rescued his people out of slavery and brought them into the land of promise, and they had rejected his love and care and concern for him. They had rejected his will. They had rejected his command. And after generation and generation and generations of warning, the northern 10 tribes, there's 12 tribes, they were conquered, and they were actually hauled off. Their cultural ties were severed deliberately. They were taken over, and then they were spread out in a way that they would lose their cultural heritage, and it was intentional. That group of people that sort of intermarried with the surrounding nations are the Samaritans in the time of Jesus. And that's something in our story later that's going to be important. And then there was the two southern tribes, the tribe of Judah and Benjamin. They survived a little bit longer. They actually had a couple of moments of sort of turning to the Lord briefly in their history and then returning to their disobedience. And then they were eventually conquered as well. They were conquered by the Babylonians. The Babylonians came in, destroyed Jerusalem, their capital city. A lot of people died. They hauled a bunch of them away, brought them to Babylon, many of them put into the service of the king, which is where the story of Daniel is found. Then, over a period of time, as Babylon escalated their own moral decay, another empire, another up-and-comer, the Persian or the Medo-Persian Empire, literally snuck in one night to Babylon and took everything over. And now they're in control. And suddenly, the remnant of Jews that were living in Babylon are now, instead of serving Babylon, they're serving the Persian Empire. That's where Esther, the story of Esther, is found. That's where we're at in the history of things. However, and this is very crucial to our story, and this is very crucial to understanding the whole scope of the redemptive story that we know as the Old Covenant. There are two very important promises that God made to his people that have not at this time been fulfilled. The first one is in 2 Samuel 7, and the promise was to David that God, through David's lineage, would establish his kingdom and put a descendant of David on the throne forever. That's a big promise. And that kingdom would provide lasting peace to God's people. So that is still outstanding. That has not yet happened. The second promise is the promise given to Jeremiah, which is actually unpacked through Jeremiah 25 and all the way up through the chapter 30. And that is that God said, I am not getting rid of you. I am not discarding you. I am disciplining you. And the discipline will be within specific parameters. The parameters are that in 70 years, I will bring you back to your homeland. So that's an outstanding promise as well. So we have these two promises of God that are still standing in the time of Esther and yet have not been fulfilled. Promises that God made to his people. So Now, before we jump into the intro, let me just tell you what's going to happen if you haven't read the story. You can cheat, you can read ahead, but let me tell you the basics of the storyline. Esther, who is a Benjamite Jew, is made queen of Persia after winning a mandatory beauty pageant, and is subsequently able to use her new position of influence to thwart a direct effort by a government official to completely annihilate her people. That's the storyline. That's the story of Esther. I personally wrestle with presenting this story for two reasons. Sometimes, those who have been victimized by others, in relationships where there's been a significant power disparity, those who have been harmed by the actions of others, will hear someone like me present a story like Esther, and they will understand me to say, just go along with it, and in the end, you'll end up queen of Persia, so it's all fine. There's some really inappropriate and unfortunate things that happen in the book of Esther, to Esther. And I wrestle with presenting those truths in a way that doesn't sort of trigger the listener, you, any of you, your own sense of being victimized by the actions of others. The second reason I wrestle with presenting this message is that it's pretty in vogue right now to talk about the abuses of male leadership and power. Have you noticed? Yes. Have you heard the word patriarchy? Do you want to talk about that this morning instead? It's pretty in vogue. The topic is male leadership and power. And this story actually includes some of the worst examples of that kind of abuse. And the story doesn't make a point to necessarily directly address that abuse. In other words, the point of the story is not to make a statement about the king and how he used his power. So then why are we going through this book? Esther. The book of Esther presents a theme that is also one of the primary themes of the whole story of Scripture and is one of the primary themes of the gospel. And I'm going to tell you it out the gate. You ready? I'm going to tell it to you, and then we're going to come back to it. Here it is. God uses the evil acts of those who reject him to accomplish his good purposes on behalf of those who love him. God uses the evil deeds of the very ones who reject his will, his commands. He uses their evil deeds to accomplish his good purposes on behalf of those who love him. Do you remember the story of Joseph? Joseph's brothers, out of jealousy, out of rage, sold their brother to get rid of him. The only reason they sold him is because they didn't want the guilty conscience of murdering him. So they sold him. And if you remember the story, we went through it here. If you remember the story, a bunch of time goes by. Joseph is now second in command in Egypt. His story is actually very similar to Esther's in many ways. He's second in command of Egypt. He interprets the Pharaoh's dream. He stores up food and saves not only their nation, but many nations from famine. And when his brothers show up, he makes a statement. He says, "What you intended for evil, what you intended for harm, what you intended to destroy me, God intended for your salvation. God used your terrible decisions to accomplish your salvation." Do you remember the story of God's son, Jesus? There has never in all of human history been an act more evil as the legally sanctioned murder of the innocent Son of God. And at the same time, that very same event is described by the biblical writers as the centerpiece of God's love for humanity. Do you feel that tension? That's a difficult tension to walk with as a person of faith and as a believer. Because on the one side, we say, no, what's bad is bad. On the other side, we say, and God is perfectly, exactly, unequivocally accomplishing his good purposes through the sin of those that he's created. And here it is. The cross is an invitation to you and I as well. To take up my cross is to act in love by taking up another person's burdens, to intervene in suffering that is not my own. The cross is not just the ministry and calling of Jesus, it is the ministry and calling of everyone who follows in Jesus' footsteps. So, now I told you we're going to do a long setup, right? You're wondering, we were talking about Esther, right? So as we go through this story, this is what I need you to do. This is what I'm asking you to do. You as the listener or as the reader, as you read the story, and we're just going to jump into the beginning, as you read the story, you will naturally, and you should, make judgments about what is right and wrong, even if the writer or the author doesn't do that. We naturally make judgments. Someone, it says, this person did this, and we go, that was not a good thing. But I want to encourage you to ask a secondary question. Is that thing leading towards God's redemptive purpose? So here we go, chapter one, the party. There was a king who threw a party, King Ahasuerus. He was king of 127 provinces, which extended from northern Africa, eastern Europe, the Middle East, and South Asia. In the third year of his reign, he held a banquet for all of his officials and attendants, for all of the army officers, the nobles, the officials of his provinces, and he put his great wealth on display. And the celebration lasted 180 days. That's a long party. And at the end of the 180 days, he held a very special celebration that lasted for 7 days in the capital city, where he invited everyone in the city, regardless of social status, regardless of income level, everyone was invited to come in and partake of the king's bounty. Everything was served on the king's vessels. Everyone is invited in to see his great wealth. It actually makes the point to say that he served a lot of alcohol, but didn't require anyone to drink it. And his wife, Vashti, also held a banquet for the women in the palace. which belong to the king. Now, throw a big party, invite everyone, give them lots of food, let them drink out of your gold cups, good or bad? I want to go. Is this party accomplishing God's redemptive purposes? Absolutely. The party is the setup. And then the king wanted to show off his wife. We got to the end of the seventh day, and it says the king's heart was very cheerful with wine. You know how people get cheerful with wine. And he sent his seven eunuchs who served in his presence to go get his wife, the queen, who was having her own party, to display her before the king to show everyone how beautiful she was. Now, is that good or bad? I see a bunch of you like, I mean, on the one hand, he's proud of her. On the other hand, I don't think this was like a meet and greet per se, right? Is God accomplishing his redemptive purposes? Yes, him inviting his wife to this party is a critical setup to the story. And his wife said, no. Verse 12, Queen Vashti refused to come to the king's order delivered by the eunuchs. No, thank you. You continue with your party, I'll continue with mine. Now, the wife saying no, is that good or bad? If you're sitting next to your spouse, answer carefully. Is Vashti saying no part of God's redemptive story? She must say no. It's critical to the setup of how God is going to accomplish his purpose in the saving of his people, the ones that he loves. His wife said no, and that made the king a little crazy. So the king became very angry, and his wrath burned within him. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I feel like he took it a little personally, honestly. Chapter 2, the fallout. This actually isn't Esther chapter 2. These are my chapters. This is how I arrange it. So the king's friends recommended a very public punishment. The story tells us, picking up in verse 13, it says, the king said to his wise men who understood the times. So he has this group of men. Their job is to have the pulse of the culture, the pulse of what's going on. And he says to them, according to our laws, what are we to do with Queen Vashti since she did not obey the command of the king delivered by his servants? So we have a couple different levels of things going on, right? We have the marital aspect. But we also have this political aspect that's tied to it. This is probably my favorite part of the story. There's some insecurity sort of bleeding through the cracks on this story. And his wise men say, well, I mean, if you let your wife get away with this, you know what I'm going home to? It's not going to be pretty. Do you know how hard I've worked to keep my woman at my house under my control? This is undermining that control. You need to do something about it, and you need to act decisively. On this day, the wives of the officials of Persia and Media who have heard about the queen's conduct, they will talk about it to all of the king's officials. And they will be filled with contempt and anger for their own husbands. So if it pleases the king, let the king issue a royal edict. Let it be written as law so that it cannot be repealed, that Queen Vashti may never enter the presence of the king's King Ahasuerus again and let her royal position be given to another who is more worthy than she. And when the king's edict, which he will make, is heard throughout his kingdom, as great as it is, then all the women will give honor to their husbands, great and small. Good or bad? I'll say it for you. Bit over the top. Is it accomplishing God's redemptive purpose for the people that he loves? It is. Her refusal and his overreaction is setting up God's plan. Now, I say overreaction, but let's be honest. If you're here and you've married, you're married, you've had this situation. My wife has had this situation many times. If I ignore those clothes on the floor and I don't say anything, that's going to be my life for the next 50 years. You know what I'm talking about? All of us are trying to train each other, right? There is no point in that. I just wanted to give him a little bit of a break. And then it says, and the king liked that plan. Now this word pleased the king and the officials. And the king did as was proposed. And so he sent out the notice to all of the king's provinces, each according to their own language. It's like the ancient version of social media. Make sure everyone, every place knows right away that Queen Vashti did not get away with this. So she was punished, she was removed, a little time went by, and then the story says, and then the king started missing her. Chapter 3, the solution. So one of the attendants, someone who was attending to the king's need, noticed that he was forlorn, missing his wife, Vashti, made a recommendation. Hey, here's an idea. Why don't you go through all of the countries that you're in charge of now and steal all of the good-looking women and bring them to your palace? Take one per night, sleep with that one, and then decide as you go if there's anyone that stands out that you would like to make queen. Bring every beautiful young virgin to the capital city, into the harem, into the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the king's women. And then let the young woman who pleases the king be made queen in place of Vashti. And the writer says, and the king liked that idea. These women were taken, brought to the capital city. They were brought into the harem. And then they were put through a 12-month spa treatment, sort of, beautification treatment. They soaked them in perfume long enough that they came out smelling nice. 12 months of this, and then they had one opportunity on one night to impress the king. And they were given whatever was requested was granted to them. Make any request, we'll give it to you for your one night with a king. And understand, for all of these women, they would go in, they would meet the king that one night, the king would have sexual relations with them, and then they would never see the king again. And they would live out their days in the king's harem as property of the king. Is that good or bad? That's terrible. Is it accomplishing God's redemptive purpose? I'm telling you, I wrestle with this story. One of those beautiful women was a Jewish girl named Hadassah. Remember, Hadassah was also named Esther, had been displaced from her home. She was living in a foreign country. She was the orphan child who had lost her parents, was being raised by her uncle, Mordecai, who seems to be a devout man. And it says that she was picked by the king to be brought into his harem because she was cursed with stunning good looks. Did Esther choose the disobedience of Israel over hundreds of years? She did not. Did Esther choose to be exiled into a foreign country for the sins of her people? She did not. Did she choose to lose her parents and be raised an orphan? She did not. Did she choose to be taken into the custody of a foreign king because of her good looks? She did not. Did she choose the life of a concubine, relegated to live out her days in the king's harem? Is all of this good or bad? I would look at this story and say, what an awful thing to see your child carried away and know whatever life I had planned, not gonna happen for her. Whatever hopes or dreams, they won't be hers. And then in a strange turn of events, Esther became queen of Persia. Now when the turn of came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai who had taken her as his daughter, when it came for her to go into the king, she did not request anything except what Haggai, the king's eunuch who was in charge of the woman, advised. She asked the guy who knew the king, "What do you suggest?" And Esther was finding favor in the eyes of all who saw her. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus in his royal palace in the 10th month, in the 7th year of his reign. So 4 years have gone by since the incident with his wife, Vashti. And the king loved Esther more than all of the women, and she found favor and kindness with him more than all of the other virgins, so that he set the royal turban on her head and he made her queen. So here's the inherent question that I see in this story and that I see being asked by the culture at large that we live in today. It's being asked in a particular way. Now understand that the world is asking and answering the question within a framework that does not include God. We must ask and answer these questions in a framework where God is central. And the question is, what does it look like to claim your power or maintain your own agency in the face of a monumental power imbalance? What does it look like to claim your power or to maintain your agency in the face of a monumental power imbalance? What does it look like to take a stand against injustice? Well, as it turns out, there are two primary ways to do so. There's the way of the world, which is assert your own independence, grab power, assert your agency, lay hold of your own happiness, do not compromise towards that goal, do not let anyone stand in the way. Demand the respect that you deserve from others. Assert your independence, your autonomy, and take hold of it. That's how you do it. And yet the scriptures present an alternative path, which I would find nearly impossible to accept, but that it was the path of the Son of God. And that is to entrust yourself to him who judges righteously. To trust his power, to assert your dependence upon him, not your independence. To lay hold of your God-given purpose without compromise. And to make the sacrifice that love requires as you give your life as an offering to him. And I would say that the true difference is probably best described as grasping versus receiving, the closed hand versus the open hand before God. 1 Peter 2, for you have been called for this purpose because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example so that you would follow in his steps. He who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth, and while being abusively insulted, he did not insult in return, and while suffering, he did not threaten, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. And as a result, he brought our sins in his body upon the cross so that we might die to sin, so that we could be free, so that we could live for righteousness. By his wounds, you were healed, for you were continually straying like sheep. Now you have returned to the shepherd and the guardian of your souls. Why entrust yourself? Because the example of Jesus and the example of Esther show us that God uses the evil acts of those who reject him to accomplish his good purpose on behalf of those who love him. Have the worship team come up. So what are you facing right now? In a room this size, there are some of you here who are on the low end of a significant power imbalance in some relationship, victimized by the decisions of others in a way that you would say is unjust and uncalled for, and you didn't deserve it. Someone else, through their sin, has negatively impacted your life. Is it good or is it bad? It's bad. But is God accomplishing his redemptive purpose? Always. Always. You're not made a victim. You're brought into the greater story, the story of God. And the question now is the same question that Jesus had to answer. Do I trust him? I don't need to subject myself to everyone's sin. But I don't need to say no to every opportunity to suffer. The pathway that's laid out for us is to entrust ourselves to the God who judges righteously and say, God, how are you leading me to walk this out in my current situation? And Paul gives us this hope. Romans 8:18, for I consider that the suffering of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed to us. There is something right now through your current suffering which might be happening at the hands of someone else who is doing you harm. And I'm not making a statement now to you directly about whether you should stay put or whether you should get away. But what I do want you to know is that God is using that suffering to form something in you and through you that when you finally see the fruit of that, Paul says, you will look back and say, Oh, there's no comparison. There's no regret. I don't regret that for a moment. Saying yes to him proved to be everything. I did not reclaim power for myself. I entrusted myself to the greater power. And let me end with this. Romans 8:31. What shall we say then to these things? If God is for us, who is against us? He who did not spare his own son, but delivered him over for us all, how will he not also with him freely give us all things? God, I pray for the person here this morning who's wrestling with the need to understand, what are you doing? What are you up to? How are you working? And is it worth it to trust you? That you would fill our hearts with faith. Give us the courage to give our yes to you. For that person here this morning, God, who feels like they're in such a vulnerable place, would you reach down with your kind, loving hands and remind their hearts that you see them, you know them. Take a few minutes. We're going to respond in worship. We're going to have prayer team ministry members over here. If you have any prayer requests of any kind, you'd like someone to support you in prayer, head on over anytime during the service. We have communion stations around the body and blood taken in remembrance of the sacrifice of Christ. And you can give during this time, but let's stand together and sing.
Jesus, quoting Isaiah, Matthew chapter 13, "You will keep on hearing, but I will not understand. You will keep on seeing, but will not receive. For the heart of this people has become dull. With their ears, they scarcely hear, and they have clogged their eyes. Otherwise, they would see with their eyes, hear with their ears, and understand with their heart and return, and I would heal them. But blessed are your eyes, because they see, and your ears, because they hear." It's the temptation of the woes and worries of today to just get past what's right in front of us. God, if you could just help me fix this one thing. You know what happens after the one thing gets fixed? There's another thing that comes up. There you go, God, I need you for this too. Can you fix this one? And what we need as God's people is not to have him fix the thing in front of us, but to take on a perspective that is above all ourselves, above the things that are laid out in front of us, to trust in him. That at the end of the day, at the end of our lives, is hope, is a future with him. That's what we're shooting for. Eyes to see as he sees, ears to hear what he's saying, to be obedient to the one who knows. We don't officially end until 12:30, so if you want to stick around and help us tear down, clean up this area, we would greatly appreciate that. Again, 6:30 tonight at Aaron's to hear a testimony. All the guys in the room, welcome to come. God bless you and keep you. Have a wonderful week.